Mr. President, to try and review your account of Watergate in one program is a daunting task, but we'll press first of all through the sort of factual record and the sequence of events as concisely as we can to begin with. But just one brief preliminary question. Reviewing now your conduct over the whole of the Watergate period, with the additional perspective now, 3 years out of office and so on, do you feel that you ever obstructed justice or were part of a conspiracy to obstruct justice?
Well, in answer to that question, I think that the best procedure would be for us to do exactly what you're going to do in this program, to go through the whole record in which I will say what I did, what my motives were, and then I will give you my evaluation as to whether those actions or anything I said, for that matter, amounted to what you have called an obstruction of justice. I will express an opinion on it, but I think what we should do is to go over it, the whole matter, so that our viewers will have an opportunity to know what we are talking about.
I'm very happy to do that, because I think the only way really to examine all of these events is on a blow-by-blow account of what occurred. So beginning with June 20 then, what did Haldeman tell you during the 18 and a half minute gap?
Haldeman's notes are the only recollection I have of what he told me. Haldeman was a very good note taker, because of course we've had other opportunities to look at his notes, and he was making the notes for my presidential files. The notes indicated
PR offensive.
That's right. The
diversion.
Notes. Well, you've asked me what it was. My recollection was that the notes showed, check the EOB to see whether or not it's bugged. Obviously, I was concerned about whether or not the other side was bugging us. I went on to say, let's get a public relations offensive on what the other side is doing in this area and so forth. And in effect, don't allow the Democratic opposition build this up into basically blow it up into a big political issue. Those were the concerns expressed. But, and I have no recollection of the conversation except that.
But as far as your general state of knowledge, that evening when you were talking with Chuck Colson on the evening of June the 20th, it suggests that from somewhere your knowledge has gone much further. You say, if we didn't know better, we'd have thought the whole thing had been deliberately botched. Colson tells you, Bob is pulling it all together. Thus far, I think we've done the right things to date. And you say, basically they're all pretty hardline guys. And you say you mean Hunt, and you say, of course, we're just going to leave this where it is with the Cubans. At times, I just stonewall it. And you also say, we've got to have lawyers smart enough to have our people delay. Now, somewhere, you were pretty well informed by that conversation on June 20th.
As far as my information on June 20th is concerned, I had been informed with regard to the possibility of Hunt's involvement. Whether I knew on the 20th or the 21st or 22nd, I knew something. I learned in that period about the possibility of Liddy's involvement. Of course, I knew about the Cubans and McCord, who were all picked up at the scene of the crime. Now, you have read here excerpts out of a conversation with Colson. And let me say, as far as what my motive was concerned, and that's the important thing, my motive was, in everything I was saying, or certainly thinking at the time, was not to try to cover up a criminal action, but to be sure that as far as any slip over, or should I say slop over, I think would be a better word, any slop over in a way that would damage innocent people or blow it into political proportions, it was that that I certainly wanted to avoid.
So you invented the CIA thing on the 23rd as a cover?
No. Now, let's use the word cover up, though, in the sense that it should be used and should not be used. If a cover up is for the purpose of covering up criminal activities, it is illegal. If, however, a cover up, as you have called it, is for a motive that is not criminal, that is something else again. And my motive was not criminal. I didn't believe that we were covering any criminal activities.
But surely in all you've just said, you have proved exactly that that was the case, that there was a cover-up of criminal activity, because you've already said, and the record shows, that you knew that Hunt and Liddy were involved. You'd been told that Hunt and Liddy were involved. At the moment when you told the CIA to tell the FBI to stop, period, as you put it, at that point, only five people had been arrested. Liddy was not even under suspicion. And so you knew in terms of intent, and you knew in terms of foreseeable consequence, that the result would be that, in fact, criminals would be protected. Hunt and Liddy, who were criminally liable, would be protected. You knew about them. By definition, by what you've said and by what the record shows, that per se was a conspiracy to obstruct justice, because you were limiting it to five people when, even if we grant the point that you weren't sure about Mitchell, you already knew about Hunt and Liddy and had talked about both.
Now,
so that is obstruction of justice.
Now, just a moment.
Period.
That's your conclusion.
It is.
But now let's look at the facts. The facts is that as far as Liddy was concerned, what I knew was only the fact that he was the man on the committee who was in charge of intelligence operations. As far as Hunt was concerned, and if you read that tape, you will find I told them to tell the FBI, they didn't know apparently, and the CIA, that Hunt was involved. And so there wasn't any attempt to keep them from knowing that Hunt was involved. The other important point to bear in mind when you ask what happened and so forth is that what happened 2 weeks later? 2 weeks later, when I was here in San Clemente, I called Pat Gray, the then FBI director, on the phone to congratulate the FBI on a very successful operation they had in apprehending some hijackers in San Francisco or someplace abroad. He then brought up the subject of the Watergate investigation. He said that there are some people around you who are mortally wounding you, or might mortally wound you, because they're trying to restrict this investigation. And I said, well, have you talked to Walters about this matter? And I said, yes. They said, does he agree? He said, yes. I said, well, Pat, I know him, had known him very well, of course, from over the years. I did call him by his first name. I said, Pat, you go right ahead with your investigation. He has so testified, and he did go ahead with the investigation.
But the point is that obstruction of justice is obstruction of justice if it's for a minute or 5 minutes, much less for the period June 23rd to July the 5th. When I think was when he talked to Walters and decided to go ahead the day before he spoke to you on July the 6th. It's obstruction of justice for however long a period, isn't it? And also, it's no defense to say that the plan failed, that the CIA didn't go along with it, refused to go along with it, said it was transparent. I mean, if I try and rob a bank and fail, that's no defense. I still tried to rob a bank. I would say you still tried to obstruct justice and succeeded for that period. He's testified. They didn't interview Agario. They didn't do all of this. And so I would have said it was a successful attempt to obstruct justice for that brief period.
Now, just a moment. You're again making the case, which, of course, is your responsibility as the attorney for the prosecution. Let me make the case as it should be made even if I were not the one who was involved for the defense. The case for the defense here is this. My motive was pure political containment, and political containment is not a corrupt motive.
Now, you, in fact, however, would say that you first learned of the cover-up on March the 21st. Is that right?
On March 21st was the date when I was first informed of the fact, the important fact to me in that conversation, was of the blackmail threat that was being made by Howard Hunt, who was one of the Watergate participants, but not about Watergate.
But in that case, if that was the first occasion, why did you say in such strong terms to Colson on February the 14th, which is more than a month before, you said to him, cover-up is the main ingredients. That's where we got to cut our losses. My losses are to be cut. The president's losses got to be cut on the cover-up deal.
Why did I say that?
February the 14th.
Well, because I read the American papers. And in January, the stories that came out, they're not just from the Washington Post, the famous series by some unnamed correspondents who have written a best-selling book since then. But the New York Times, the networks, and so forth were talking about hush money. They were talking about clemency for cover-up and all the rest. It was that I was referring to at that point. I was referring to the fact that there was a lot of talk about cover-up and that this must be avoided at all costs.
But there's one very clear self-contained quote, and I read the whole of this conversation of February the 13th, which I don't think has ever been published, but this is to Colson. When I'm speaking about Watergate, though that's the whole point of the election, this tremendous investigation rests unless one of the seven begins to talk. That's the problem. Now, in that remark, it seems to me that someone running the cover-up couldn't have expressed it more clearly than that, could they?
What do we mean by one of the seven beginning to talk? How many times do I have to tell you that as far as these seven were concerned, the concern that we had, certainly that I had, was that men who worked in this kind of covert activity, men who, of course, realize it's dangerous activity to work in, particularly since it involves illegal entry, that once they're apprehended, they are likely to say anything. And the question was, I didn't know of anybody at that point, nobody on the White House staff, not John Mitchell, anybody else, that I believed was involved criminally. But on the other hand, I certainly could believe that a man like Howard Hunt, who was a prolific book writer, or any one of the others, under the pressures of the moment, could have started blowing and putting out all sorts of stories to embarrass the administration, and as it later turned out in Hunt's case, to blackmail the president to provide clemency or to provide money or both.
I still just think, though, that one has to go contrary to the normal usage of language of almost 10,000 gangster movies to interpret this tremendous investigation rests unless one of the seven begins to talk. That's the problem. There's anything other than some sort of conspiracy to stop him talking about something damaging the speech.
You can state your conclusion, and I've stated my view.
That's
so
fair.
Now we go on with the rest of it.
What President Nixon knew of the cover-up before March the 21st is disputed. But there is no dispute that on March the 21st, John Dean did lay out many of the key elements of the cover-up for the president. Dean recited the history of the break-in and listed the criminal liability of top presidential aides like Haldeman, and Ehrlichman and Dean himself for actions which followed the burglary. Dean told the president that hundreds of thousands of dollars had been paid to keep the Watergate burglars silent through their January trial. He said further that with sentencing only 2 days away, Howard Hunt was now demanding a payment of $120,000 for continued silence. And Dean suggested that the price tag for blackmail could total $1 million. The period following the meeting on March the 21st, up to April the 30th, when Haldeman and Ehrlichman resigned, is crucial. The president would later claim that he worked to get the truth out during this period. His critics would claim that he continued to cover it up. Looking back on the record now of that conversation, as I'm sure you've done, in addition to the overall details, which we'll come to in a minute, bearing in mind that a payment probably was set in motion prior to the meeting and was certainly not completed until late the evening of the meeting, wouldn't you say that the record of the meeting does show that you endorsed or ratified what was going on with regard to the payment to Hunt?
No, the record doesn't show that at all. In fact, the record actually is ambiguous until you get to the end, and then it's quite clear. Let me say, I did consider the payment of $120,000 to Hunt's lawyer and to Hunt for his attorney's fees and for support. I considered it not because Hunt was going to blow, using our gangster language here, on Watergate, but because, as the record clearly shows, Dean says, it isn't about Watergate, but it's going to talk about some of the things he's done for Ehrlichman. As far as the payment of the money was concerned, when the total record is read, you will find that it seems to end on a basis which is indecisive. But I clearly remember, and you undoubtedly have it in your notes there, my saying that the White House can't do it, I think, was my last words, because I had gone through the whole scenario with Dean. I laid it out. I said, look, what would it cost? I mean, when you're talking about all of these people, what would it cost to take care of them?
They
talked about $1 million. And yeah. I said, well, you could raise the money, but doesn't it finally get down to a question of clemency? And he said, yes. I said, well, you can't provide clemency, and that would be wrong for sure. Now, if clemency is the bottom line, then providing the money isn't going to make any sense.
But when we talk about the money, the $120,000 demand, that in fact he got $75,000 of that evening, bearing in mind what you were saying earlier about reading the overall context of the conversation, is there any doubt when one reading the whole conversation, one, you could get $1 million and you could get it in cash, I know where it could be gotten. Two, your major guy to keep under control is Hunt. Don't you have to handle Hunt's financial situation? Four, let me put it frankly, I wonder if that doesn't have to be continued. Five, get $1 million. It would seem to me that would be worthwhile. Six, don't you agree that you'd better get the Hunt thing? Seven, that's worth it and that's buying time on. So, eight, we should buy the time on that, as I pointed out to John. Nine, Hunt has at least got to know this before he's sentenced. 10, first you've got the Hunt problem. That ought to be handled. 11, the money can be provided. Mitchell could provide the way to deliver it. That could be done. See what I mean? 12, but let's come back to the money. They were off on something else here, desperate to get away from the money, bored to death with the continued references to the money. $1 million and so forth and so on. Let me say that I think you could get that in cash. 13, that's why your immediate thing, you've got no choice with Hunt but the 120 or whatever it is, right? 14, would you agree that this is a buy time thing? You better damn well get that done, but fast. 15, now who's going to talk to him? Coulson? 16, we have no choice, and so on. Now, reading as you've requested,
yes, right,
the thing,
fine,
in the whole context...
Let me just stop you right there. You're doing something here which I am not doing, and I will not do throughout these broadcasts. You have every right to. You are reading there, out of context, out of order, because I have read this and I know it really better than you do.
I'm sure you
do. And I should know it better because I was there. It's no reflection on you. You know it better than anybody else I know, incidentally, and you're doing it very well. But I am not going to sit here and read the thing back to you.
And I agree.
And let me say that in this
instance,
though,
we're talking about.
And in this instance, the very last thing you read, do you ever have any choice with Hunt? Why didn't you read the next sentence? Why did you leave it off?
Carried on.
No. The reason, the next sentence says, as I remember that so well, but you never have a choice with Hunt. Do you ever have one, rhetorically? You never have a choice with Hunt. Because when you finally come down to it, it gets down to clemency. Now, why, after all of that horror story, and it was, I mean, even considering that, I mean, must horrify people. Why would you consider paying money to somebody who's blackmailing the White House? I've tried to give you my reasons. I was concerned about what he would do. But my point is, after that, why not? Why not you do what was not done by Mr. Jaworski in his book? What was not done by Mr. Doar before the Senate Judiciary Committee? Read the last sentence. The last sentence, which says, after that, do you never have any choice with that? Because it finally comes down to clemency. And I'd said six times in that conversation, you didn't read that in your 10 things. Six times I said, you can't provide clemency. Let me tell you what happened after the meeting. And you were, incidentally, very fair to point out, and the record clearly shows, that Dean did not follow up in any way on this. The payment that was made, Dean didn't know it. I didn't know it. Nobody else knew it. Apparently, it was being made contemporaneously that day through another source.
But the next morning, Mitchell told Haldeman that it had been paid, and in the later transcript, you agree with Haldeman that he told you. You say yes. You reported that to me.
Yes, I understand. So you were very soon
aware it had gone through.
That's right. But my point is, the question we have is whether or not the payment was made as a result of a direction given by the president for that purpose. And the point is, it was not.
Well, there's two things, sir, to be said to that. One is, I think that the my reading of the tapes tells me, trying to read it in an open-minded way, that the writing, not just between the lines, but on so many of the lines as I quoted, is very, very clear that you were, in fact, endorsing at least the short-term solution of paying this sum of money to buy time. That would be my reading of it. But the other point to be said is, here's Dean talking about this hush money for Hunt, talking about blackmail, and all of that. I would say that you endorsed or ratified it. But let's leave that on one side for a minute.
I didn't endorse or ratify it.
Why didn't you stop it?
Because at that point, I had nothing to, no knowledge of the fact that it was going to be paid. The point that I make is this. It's possible, it's a mistake that I didn't stop it. The point that I make is that I did consider it. I've told you that I considered it. I considered it for reasons that I thought were very good ones. I would not consider it for the other reasons, which would have been, in my view, bad ones.
But that night, though, the night of the 21st, I mean, in the conversation with Colson after you'd been exchanging dialogue about getting off the reservation and so on, Colson said to you something about the fact that it's the stuff after the cover-up. I don't care about the people involved in the cover-up, it's the stuff after that's dangerous, Dean and other things, and the things that have been done. And you said, as I'm sure you know, you mean with regard to the defendants. Of course, that had to be done. Brackets, laughs, whatever that means. But I mean, so that night you were saying that had to be done. You were realizing that doing something for the defendants was a necessity.
No, I don't interpret that way at all.
How do you
recall that? I can't recall that conversation, and I can't vouch for the accuracy of the transcription on that. But I do say
that's an exhibit in the Watergate trial.
The tapes that have been made public on the 22nd, with regard to my, and the one on the 21st as well, with regard to the whole payments problem, I think are very clear with regard to my attitude.
But on the short-term point, that was an exhibit and part of the basic file at the trial, was that conversation, Colson saying, it's the stuff after that's dangerous, and you saying, you mean with regard to the defendants, of course, that was, that had to be done. Brackets, laughs. I mean, that's absolutely on the record and authenticated and played publicly.
Yes. Well, I can't interpret it at this